It is Saturday, January 25th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org.
Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software geeks in Western Russia, who provide engineering support for IP telephony, networking, and unified communication. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
And it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind, the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or of any of their affiliated organizations. So basically, if you hear us talking about it, it's our opinion only. My name's Lyle Troxell. I'm a programmer and photographer and sometimes radio host. And in the air with me is Lindsay Lonnie. She's a systems analyst and web developer. Hi, Lindsay.
Good morning.
Mr. Ben Jaffe, a web developer and web developer instructor, musician, and world traveler. Hi.
Yo. It's a mouthful.
It is. And a Mr. Miles Elam. Now, I've got mic 5 up, but it says mic 4 on the one you're on. Let me hear you. That's what I thought. Unfortunately, we need to get mic 5 for you, sir. So look behind you and snag that thing while we cover some news.
I can do a good Miles voice, maybe. No,
I don't think so. I mean, I'm sure you can.
Good morning.
Oh, sorry. Said.
Good morning.
Yes, it's beautiful, sir. Thank you so much. So let's talk about anniversaries first. Anything interesting this month or today in history?
Did you know that Dungeons and Dragons, the game, is 40 years old?
Oh, yes.
January 1974.
That's beautiful.
Happy birthday, D&D.
Happy birthday. See, I know that because D&D was actually made for me. I was born in 74 as well. So
was I.
Yeah. Okay. See, we should be playing D&D this year.
It's closer to you, though, so maybe it was made for you.
All right, cool. Anything else?
I've got one, too. It's rare that we have an anniversary on the Saturday. You know, a lot of things happen during the week and, you know, things like that. Well, this is actually the 10-year anniversary of Opportunity, or one of our Mars rovers landing on Mars. That was January 25th today, but 10 years ago, 2004. And we put Opportunity and forgetting the other one's name,
Spirit.
But we put Spirit. Thank you. Yeah, we put two Mars rovers on there, and one of them is not operating anymore, but Opportunity is.
And awesome. We covered the stories when they were first put out there. That's how long Geekspeak's been on the air.
That's fantastic. Man.
You know,
that's right.
that mission had a minimal mission time of 90 days, and it's been 10 years,
and they're still functional.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, what one? The one that I've been covering. Opportunity
has a stuck wheel, but it's still plugging along.
In fact, going in circles.
in fact, the stuck wheel may have been responsible for upturning the donut-shaped rock that they discovered recently. The one where the rock wasn't there, and then they took another photo of the section of ground, and there was a rock there. Like, hey, what's this?
Oh, so like toss it up from the wheel spinning.
Yeah, and it was the side of the rock had not been. Exposed to the Martian atmosphere for over a billion years.
Oh, cool.
I personally think it's a Horta, which is a Star Trek alien. Kind of looks like a rock.
Okay, good.
Yeah. And right. Like three people chuckle out there.
You know, since we're okay, well, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about yesterday. Was kind of a big day on internet, in the internet space. What happened, Lindsay?
Well, Google had an outage yesterday, which is a big deal for a lot of people. There's even businesses that use Google for their daily email. So the email outage started around 11 a.m. Pacific time and lasted between, 15, 25 minutes for a lot of people. The other services like Calendar, Talk, Drive, Docs, Sheets, Slides, Drawings, Sites, Group, Voice, Google Plus, Hangouts.
Oh, wow, that's a lot. Yeah.
Also had short outages.
Shorter outages than the email?
I don't know the timing.
Okay.
You know, they I haven't been able to find a ton of details about it online, and I think that things came back online gradually and not like for everyone at once, like a big switch,
yeah.
So it's hard to pinpoint. But ironically, Google site reliability engineers were hosting a Reddit Ask Me Anything during the downtime. Talk about being in the hot seat.
Coincidentally. Not ironically.
Oh, coincidentally?
Not irony? Okay.
It's like 10,000 spoons when all
you need
is a knife.
Isn't that irony?
No.
That's Alanis Morissette
so,
irony.
Oh, okay. So it's Alanis Morissette.
Dictionary definition of irony for all those out there.
Yes.
It's where the actual meaning is the exact opposite of the implied meaning.
Okay.
Oh, okay. So you have to have an implied meaning for irony to exist.
Yes.
If the implied meaning is that Google will be up.
Does it have to be the exact opposite? Or just the opposite?
No, the idea of irony is that it's the exact opposite. That's the point of it, is you're saying something that's the exact opposite to illustrate.
Do you have an example of irony, Miles? So you think about that for a while. Let's go on.
Yes. In the movie Roxanne, they actually cover this where...
Roxanne?
Roxanne.
You don't Roxanne. Oh, I think it's Roxanne.
No, Roxanne.
Roxanne. Oh, yeah.
Where Daryl Hannah is in the bushes. Her cat has locked her out of the house without a...
Gosh, that's a good
on.
Movie. I got to watch that movie again.
Yeah, and he says, do you want me to bring in any clothes? No, I'd like to stand out here in the freezing cold. That is just an example of it. She obviously wants to have clothes brought out to her, but she said the exact opposite.
Irony.
As an ironic statement.
Great.
Thank you for the education,
Miles. I think it's funny that when people use the word irony wrong, it often is ironic. It's meta-irony.
So,
or is
actually,
that recursive
it
irony?
It can be.
I feel it spinning
out of control. Okay. All right, Lindsay. So this outage, what we know about it is the services were unpredictable in the morning of yesterday for Google, which is not like Google. Normally, they're really rock solid. Mm-hmm. And we had a long period of time where an email wasn't available and other services were affected as well. Is there any public statement about this? Is there any kind of like what happened kind of thing?
I didn't check this morning, but as of looking yesterday, they immediately put something up on their page saying that the services were unavailable and that they would be, you know, I don't think they said they'd be back up soon. I didn't see what the actual message was. Yahoo actually tweeted a screenshot of it and then later apologized and took it down. But people turned to Twitter and said a lot of really funny things. But I don't know the exact answer for that.
It's funny that Yahoo decided to publicly humiliate Gmail on their Twitter feed, given that Yahoo had, what was it, a multi-day
outage last month.
Like last month?
Yeah. Not much ground to stand on there.
Yeah, it was a really bad day for Gmail. There's actually another glitch that there was a story on. I'm not sure how long this glitch was around. I personally don't, I'm not convinced that this is related directly with the glitch Lindsay was just talking about. But there's a Gmail glitch where when people searched for Gmail and then clicked on the sublink under the Gmail search result, it would actually open up a compose email window which had an address filled in already, which is some random user. And it's not even a Gmail user. It's some guy at hotmail.com. So when people searched for Gmail and clicked on one of the search results, they had a compose window that was an email all ready to go out to this guy. And so...
Oh, interesting.
It was really strange. So this one guy...
The link being returned from the search results was a shortcut to a compose message with an email address in it.
Already filled in, yes.
Yeah.
So that's extremely awkward, first of all, especially given that the compose message was going to a Hotmail account, not a Gmail account. And so apparently...
Does that mean a lot of people sent email to this person?
Yeah.
Because you don't really think about it.
I think the guy might have gone over quota.
Yeah. On Hotmail, I would assume.
So TechCrunch actually got in touch with the guy. I'm sure a good number of people got in touch with the guy. And the guy says, quote, "I've been getting thousands of no subject blank emails," he says. 500 of them come in every hour. I can't stop them. I want to stop them. I deleted everything last night and woke up this morning and I had 1,900 new emails.
Wait, two of them. What do you mean you can't stop them? That's exactly what email filters are for.
Yes. It's Hotmail, though. I have to say, I think what this was is a strategic objective from Google. They just wanted to get rid of the last Hotmail user. So they're just destroying his account.
Oh, right. that's a low blow. Okay.
All right. So these are, you know, temporary services problems. Who knows? I mean, that's a search results search issue, kind of, because it's really, you can link to lots of different types of documents, and I'm assuming that's what it was. I could make a page that would also create a new email that would be linked to Geeks. In fact, I think a link on our website is linked to geeks@geekspeak.org, so people can send us email, right? That's a common website thing you can do. So that doesn't seem too creepy, but the outage is really interesting.
Yeah, there's nothing creepy about it.
No,
it's just an awkward
mistake.
But
when you have something in mass like that, it can affect people.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what about things that are a little more disconcerting?
Well, this is not disconcerting enough.
I wasn't the guy with the Hotmail account.
Yeah, I wasn't in the middle of a board meeting when that happened. So, yeah, mm-hmm. There was actually one of the largest internet outages that happened on Tuesday, but a lot of us over on this side of the pond don't know about it because it happened in China. For 8 hours on Tuesday, more than 618 million Chinese couldn't access the internet. It occurred when 2/3 of all web traffic in the country was blocked from accessing top-level domains like .com and .net, and all the traffic was redirected to a single IP address located in the United States.
Was it that guy's Hotmail account?
The same guy.
Poor guy.
The internet has it out for him. So the IP belongs to Dynamic Internet Technology, which has ties to Falun Gong, which is a spiritual group outlawed in China since 99.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah.
That means that they were trying to block that particular site and instead made sure that everyone saw that site.
Exactly.
Did it get it functional? So if the people asked for kittens, all of a sudden they got that site? I mean, was it in that way? Whoa.
Well, I'm sure the site went down, but...
Yeah.
So Chinese news sites reported that they thought it might be caused by hackers launching a cyber attack, but everyone, else has been saying that they think that somebody was trying to make changes to the what they call the Great Firewall, which in China, almost all legal traffic goes through that Great Firewall, and that instead of blocking traffic to that site, it redirected all traffic to that site. Yeah, 8 hours, no internet.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty severe. So, I love that it's a side effect of the Great Wall, Great Firewall of China, that it was just an error
If you've ever configured firewall before, how easy it is to make mistakes. I mean, mm-hmm. Everyone who's had to do that consistently as part of their career at home has probably locked themselves out or redirected traffic somewhere they didn't mean to.
Yeah, accidentally block SSH.
Right,
yeah.
And they have such complicated firewall going to, redirect all traffic. I can see something like that might be able to happen.
I can see.
Yeah, the common thing was you have your configuration, but you don't persist it. And then you see if it works, and if it doesn't, then sometimes you'll have a watchdog that will
reload the older ones so that,
mm-hmm. Or you just don't save it so that, something goes wrong, you can unplug and,
It's kind of complicated version of changing your display resolution on old versions of Windows. You change it to too high of a thing, and hopefully it switches back if your monitor can't display it.
Right. You got 15 seconds of countdown, it'll switch back.
So your monitor doesn't explode.
All right.
But, I've had situations where I've accidentally hit escape, and then I'm stuck in a screen resolution. I can't see the screen.
Have you tried, this is you're talking about an XP days, right? Where then you're going, okay, wait, where would my cursor be right now? How can I open a new window? You're trying to open window completely blind and toggle over.
I had an identical machine right next to it.
Oh,
and
cool.
So I booted both. I shut both down, and I booted both up. And, of course, one I couldn't see the screen, and one I could. And I used tab and spacebar and enter and the arrow keys and everything to navigate around the entire interface on both computers identically, just only using the keyboard, and managed to somehow get myself into the right place to change the resolution back.
Well, that was more awesome than my rendition, which was trying to fix resolution modes
in
the X Windows system early Linux.
Man. I remember hours of time, Miles, of us sitting in cold server rooms trying to get the Geekspeak server up with you modifying config file, things like that.
No, well, I never did the mode lines.
No. Not there.
That was always a desktop thing. I don't know. I always remember setting up the Geekspeak server and you and Sean going, hey, let's do this hardware. And I'm sitting in the backyard. I really want to install you guys. It's already midnight. Please, can I start doing the OS install?
So what happened with this outage?
The Chinese outage.
Eight hours and they got it back up, or?
Yeah, my guess, and there's not a lot of details to be found,
is
that somebody made this change and that they have some complicated restarting of, propagating of the configuration file through different servers, and that they had to, once they figured out what happened, they had to make a change, and then the change had to propagate.
I'm curious if there was something more devious about it, if they were hiding information, but I'm assuming it would have leaked by this point. In just a moment, Miles is going to tell us even more about creepy government stuff, and then we'll get into some social news as well. So stay with us here on Geekspeak. You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxel. With me in the air room is Lindsay Lonnie, Miles Elam, and Ben Jaffe. More about everything we talk about is available at geekspeak.org. And, of course, you can participate with us on social networks and the like. And just go to geekspeak.org to find out where we are. Lindsay, what are we listening to in the background here?
So this is a piece of music created by a company called Gantt. They sonified 36 years worth of NASA Voyager spacecraft data and converted it to a duet between the two spacecraft. So,
how'd they do it? Ben, you're our expert programmer and musician.
I looked around and it seems like just a bunch of arbitrary transformations. It's really cool. It's a really neat idea to take actual data from some source and turn it into some kind of an art form or something. In terms of what it means or what you can pull from it other than, oh, that's pretty.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure. So,
you know, I was thinking about this after we talked about it, and it's kind of like if a painter goes and paints at a location and it's an abstract painting.
Yeah.
And it's not really, they're not trying to reproduce reality, but they're trying to produce a piece of art based off of an environment. That's how this music is generated, right? It's based off the data. It is using the numbers.
A bit more abstract than that, but sure, you know. Like you could cool. say maybe, well, yeah, I'm not going to get into that.
All right.
We have more geek bits though, too.
Yeah, so geek bit is something that you really got to see to understand, so we recommend you take a look at these things at geekspeak.org. Ben, go for it.
Oh yeah, so I've got a geek bit, which is that we have a mission going to a comet, and I'm not going to talk a whole bunch about it right now. The news is basically that it woke back up after it swung around the sun and everything was successful. The thing I want to share with you guys, and go to geekspeak.org to see these pictures, is as Rosetta was going by the Earth, it took these incredible pictures of our planet. You know, one of them is just this, you've seen a crescent moon before, right?
Sure.
Like the really thin crescent moon. It looks like that, but it's Earth.
Cool.
And then there's another one where you can see the moon, just this wisp of moon, and then the Earth right there. It's just, they're so awesome. Beautiful. So those will be up at geekspeak.org.
Miles, any other reasons to go visit geekspeak.org?
Yes. For many years, there were many people skeptical about whether ball lightning existed.
Yeah.
People actually thought that it was a mass hallucination. Like a lot of people over time, you just have these visual artifacts in your brain because some random neurons were firing, or maybe there was a mass hallucination because they were just so scattered and you have no idea why. Someone has caught ball lightning on video.
Oh, awesome. What does it look like? Well, go to geekspeak.org.
Ball of plasma.
Does it float in the air? Does it go just in one direction, or does it seem to shift along the air?
It was in a tube, an enclosed tube, and so it doesn't move. Well, it does move somewhat, but that's. I'll leave it to the listener when they go to the site. Although they do have a better insight now as to what causes ball lightning.
Cool, awesome, thank you so much. So we were just talking about the outage in Chinese government, the internet outage, but also something's happened that's a little more creepy with regards to government. Miles, you want to hear this?
So imagine you are a protester in the Ukraine. You're in the capital city of Kiev. And you are very upset about the state of government at that moment.
The
government has passed a new law prohibiting public demonstrations.
Hmm.
Which, as a protester, if you are not happy with the government, you're probably going to say, what? No, you should absolutely be able to protest.
Sure.
At which point, a huge number of people on their cell phone received a text message about at the same time saying, quote, "Dear subscriber, you are registered as a participant in a mass disturbance."
Creepy.
In other words, the government went to the local telecom, had them figure out which people were in the area at the time, and had them send a text message, thereby letting the protester know
they've been targeted.
Yeah, that the government knows who they are individually.
It's possible the government doesn't know, but probable.
And they are asserting they are in violation of a law.
Yeah. So is this is, it seems creepy because it's a personal device and it's targeted, but if they were on a blowhorn in that area as well and using, you know, a large amplification system said, if you can hear our voice, you're in violation of the law. Isn't it similar?
It is not, because that is not targeted to the individual. Because of the ability in the modern world to be able to figure out who someone is by their location, because your cell phone is a pretty good indicator of the location of that person. To be able to now not just say, oh, we know that there's a whole lot of protesters and here are maybe some ringleaders. Mm-hmm. It becomes, we can identify when and where each individual protester is any given moment. And then after the protest is over, we can target them afterwards.
Yeah.
So this opens up a whole new level for retribution. And
this is in Kiev?
This is in the Ukraine, Kiev. Yeah.
And did you inspect the story pretty well? I'm just curious, if was the telco giving the numbers back to the government, or was the telco just issuing a send message to a region? Because we have regional text message support. The Amber Alert system is used that way, and there's other systems that can actually send mass location-based text messages.
You are right. I am making a supposition that they went to the telco and got that. However,
it's unlikely.
Yeah, and forgive me for using this overused word, but it is quite dystopic.
Yes.
Where it is very much like the Orwellian, we are watching you. Mm-hmm. You know, Big Brother is watching you. To say that, did the government just tell the telco, just send it to everyone in that area? If you were a government that was trying to crack down on protest, is that what you would do?
If I was evil dictating?
Well, when you say evil, that puts in all sorts of different connotations. I mean, like, if you were in the position of a government official that thought that cracking down on protest was a legitimate goal, would you say to the telco, I don't really want to know who the person is, I just want you to send a blanket text to everyone in that area?
It's tricky.
You also say, send a text message to everyone in that area and give me a list of the people that you sent it to?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like something the government might want to do. I would agree. All right, cool. Thanks for the story. I mean, I'm saying cool in the sense that it's interesting.
Cool,
It is that time of year.
What's that?
To be cool.
How so?
I'm through with being cool.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is why we live in California. Ba-dum-bum.
Let's cover some social news now, shall we? What's going on with Facebook, Lindsay?
So Princeton released a study last week saying that they predicted that Facebook would lose 80% of its users by 2015 to 2017.
I saw this. I got a whole bunch of press releases from other companies quoting the Princeton article and then saying, therefore, you should have this person on the show to talk about blah, blah, blah. I'm like, wait. So I went to look for this Princeton article. I couldn't find it. So I'm glad that there's actually more information about it and some response. So basically, the idea would be that it is an 80% loss in the next 2 years of current active Facebook users. What they base that on? Why are they saying this?
So since then, they've caught a lot of flack for the study. It was not peer-reviewed, and their methodologies were questionable in how they came up with their solutions. So the kind of amusing thing is that this week, Facebook's data scientists turned the study's methodology against it to show that Princeton would lose all of its students by 2021. So what they ended up doing was the study makes a strained analogy comparing Facebook to a disease that users eventually recover from.
That's the best starting point for.
They also use MySpace as an example of how users recover from a social network and abandon it sort of naturally. But they make no mention of how MySpace was abandoned because Facebook came along in a lot of cases. They also use a lot of correlation equals causation methodology, stating that since the volume of Google searches for Facebook began declining in 2012, it must mean that there's an ongoing decline in Facebook usage. But back in the web heyday around, Facebook's heyday around 2007, lots of people did surf to that place by typing in Facebook and then logging into the site. But now people are using the mobile app, so it could just be that all those users are actually just using the mobile app instead of going to the login page through Google. So it's a little, it was kind of funny how they just turned the study back around on them and said, oh, well, Princeton's going to be debunked by 2021 as well.
Yeah, and I was always under the impression that I left MySpace because it had really gaudy pictures on everyone's profile. And as soon as you went to their page, two different songs would start playing simultaneously very loud volume.
Yeah, and Facebook doesn't let you do those things. And therefore, it's a little better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. It's you know, this is an article by Princeton researchers. It's not... So, you know, I worked at UCSC for years. And there are a lot of people at a community that can say... doing research at UCSC, right? Mm-hmm. I could have said that at some point. And so it matters quite a bit who the researcher is, not just that they're a member of this community that happens to be Princeton. And I think that's a big part of this issue, that we think that an institute that comes out, like the Princeton does reviews of graduate schools, right? And that is a kind of a hallmark of whether your grad school is good. Mm-hmm. So that's all I want to say about it.
Yeah, it's interesting from somebody. I was wondering if somebody would chime in who knows more about academia, because I was thinking to myself, well, what if this is just two students that had a paper due, you know, and they thought, ooh, it'll be fun to do this thing. But I don't know how those things work as far as goes.
What the release channels are or anything for
various
things.
Right, and because it was sensational, because it's about Facebook, that's why it got all the publicity. I don't know how that works, but I just thought it was pretty funny how Facebook replied to that.
Yeah, so the actual review, the abstract and everything is available, and you can read it. It's John Cannamarella and Joshua Spitcher, and they're in the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at Princeton University. There's two people who wrote the article, and of course, because it's a educational institute, the document starts with their email address, so of course you can just ask them too.
Awesome. There's more Facebook stuff if you're interested.
Yeah, let's jump right back into Facebook. I think that makes sense.
Let's do it.
All right, let's do it. So... there's a hacker, a white hat hacker, meaning, you know, they try to find vulnerabilities in a company's sites or software, and they report it to the company first before reporting it to the public so that the company can repair it before anyone else finds out about it.
Or the company has an opportunity to, not that
right.
They always do.
Right, they have an opportunity. And sometimes there are bounties offered for hackers finding these kinds of vulnerabilities. So Facebook offers some bounties. And they paid out their largest cash reward so far of $33,500 for a remote execution vulnerability, mm-hmm. which returned critical admin data.
So what is a remote execution vulnerability?
Essentially, somebody can get, like a hacker or somebody can remotely execute code like XML on a web page if there's a vulnerability. I don't know how better to describe that. Maybe Miles
will. Remotely excluding XML and turn to Hives.
Well, yeah.
But what does remote execute vulnerability mean, Miles? Lindsay, you did a fine job describing it. We need to do it even more, I think.
Yeah, I knew Miles would have some.
A remote executable vulnerability would be something like some outside person. This could either be because you navigated to a site and someone came in through your browser, or it could be that you have a TCP IP port, some service running on your system that is vulnerable. But basically, a remote entity is able to exploit a defect in the software. And it may not be a defect that you would normally see. It mm-hmm. may be something... It may be something along the lines of, you have 5 buckets by your house in order to catch some leak that's coming off of, you know, the hose.
Right.
And it's always good enough for that amount of leak. But someone knows about that, and so they make the hole in your hose a little bit larger so that it overflows the 5 buckets. You don't have anything else to hold the water with.
Right. So they see some kind of problem that is esoteric, maybe, and they take advantage of that to then do what? What's the execution part of it?
So what it will do is, usually it's like a common one is a buffer overflow attack. You'll have... Someone is going to enter in some data into my website or enter data into this program. And I don't think they're going to use, they're going to type anything in that's longer than, say, 100 characters.
Mm-hmm.
And so I make what's called a buffer, 100 characters or 100 bytes long.
In the program.
And someone figures that out and says, oh, well, maybe if I write more than 100 characters... And it goes off, and once a program is always stacked up so that data is right next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
If I write more than that, I start writing into the program itself. And then I can, if I know exactly what the program is doing at the next point, I can then say, oh, well, rewrite it with this other information.
And so you are rewriting a running program, and therefore the program that's now running is actually your program. And so you are executing your own code, even though you did this remotely. So you didn't install the software. You just took advantage of a vulnerability, which basically installed your application into the running memory space of the computer, and you're able to execute arbitrary code. So that's what it is. So,
and
Lindsay,
beyond that, not just executing code, but you have access to what the executing code has access to.
Right.
So if there are admin credentials or something that you have access to, if you're in the program there, then all of a sudden the attacker has access to that too.
So a little more details about, you know, where the vulnerability lies. So this bounty was tied to a flaw in the implementation of OpenID. So OpenID allows you to say, I'm going to go to Facebook and use my Gmail ID to log in, which a lot of us have seen that kind of thing.
Is it the other side too, where if you're at a site, you can log in through Facebook? Is that the part that got vulnerable, or the logging through Facebook with a different service?
Logging through Facebook with a different
service. Oh, I didn't know they offered that.
And specifically Gmail.
Okay.
So this hacker found out that Facebook has used OpenID to allow users accessing their accounts by logging into Gmail. So after reading the documentation for OpenID, this guy, Reginaldo Silva, he learned that he could manipulate that process, which is known as Yardis discovery, to replace the Gmail for a provider that he controlled.
Oh, nice. I mean, a nice hack.
Right.
Yeah.
And then with that alteration in place, he caused Facebook to issue a request to his URL instead of the Gmail URL. And it replied with a request carrying malicious XML and that he had put together. And the Facebook response included its Etsy password.
Oh, my God.
Which contained essential login information, like the system administrator data and user IDs.
Okay, so now the hackling, the XML, remote execution through XML just made my skin crawl.
Yeah.
Miles, I don't think we'll get into that on GeekSpeak, but yes, I see your point. It shouldn't be, anyway, we had a vulnerability with Ruby like that recently where the file format, the file structure format shouldn't have been able to run
code.
Although
from that description, that does sound like they wouldn't have been able to get the actual password data, because nowadays no system has readable password data.
Right, but they could authenticate.
They can know who the users are, which is important.
And they can see the access level of, you know, potentially other files and things like that, which is
If
important.
They got the groups file, yeah, you would know that too. And assuming that wasn't being held in LDAP, which that's a whole other...
the details behind the scenes.
This is complicated, folks.
But this was a big one, you know, like, and they're very fortunate that he's the one that found this.
Now, what this project is that, you know, Facebook knows that they're a big target, so they offer a bounty for anybody that finds vulnerabilities. When they get the information first, they're able to fix it, then they pay the person, and then they describe what happened.
Right.
So it's a kind of neat way of dealing with the problem. Now, it's also very common on GeekSpeak. We talk about companies have a vulnerability, and then for 6 months, someone's telling them about it, and finally the person just says, hey, everybody, here's a vulnerability. They're not fixing it. Mm-hmm. And that happens all the time as well. So Facebook being responsive is a lot better than not.
And how responsive they were is that he wrote this great paper describing what happened, sent it to them. By the time he got back from lunch, it had been repaired and released. So he was hoping that he'd have an ability to exploit it more, to get more
press
money and cred
or
press. And by the time he had sent it and come back from eating, it was done. It was fixed. So
well done, Facebook.
But
I'm impressed.
He was hoping to get more because someone had released a statement saying that if somebody could get access to certain admin information, that it would be worth $1 million. But that was just a generic statement made by someone. So he was hoping for more. And a lot of other companies are saying, well, if someone else had found that, it would have cost you a lot more than that. Why aren't you giving more?
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
And someone that can discover that and do that with Facebook, they're not going to have a problem with employment.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. It has its other perks.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's interesting. The way that Facebook actually runs teams is they have small teams of people that do development, and they work on a goal and develop. And all their engineers actually have push capability directly to the system. So they can roll things out all the time, which is kind of impressive that they're that nimble.
You know, what's also interesting is we're saying good job, Facebook, on your security thing. But we also very often talk about privacy, you know, Facebook, bad job, privacy. That's very much the difference. We talked about that in a previous episode, the difference between like social security, which is really privacy, and technical security, which Facebook is excelling at in this situation.
Yeah.
So
I think that the social, you know, privacy aspect that we get upset about with Facebook is because we don't actually have a social norm built around it. We don't know what the right thing to do is, and they're the ones doing it first, and so we go wrong. You're listening to Geek Speak. In the air with me is Lindsay Lonnie, Ben Jaffe, and Miles Elam. We're taking calls now in the second half, though we do have a lot more stories. So we're about to take one call from Eli, a really interesting one. But first, let's do some space news. So, Ben, what's first?
Yeah, this is a really cool one. So for the second time ever, we've detected an asteroid before it's impacted Earth.
Okay.
We've only detected two. This is the second one. That's scary to me.
Has it impacted Earth now?
It has. And okay. It was a small one, so that's good, right? Because it didn't cavitate the oceans or anything.
We're still
like
here,
that.
Is what you're
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, we're still here. It was a pretty small one. It's a couple meters across.
Yeah, small in the cosmic sense.
Yeah. Well, it's
I wouldn't want to have it land on my head.
Did it hit Earth?
Or did it get to the atmosphere? It disintegrated over the Atlantic Ocean. Okay. But what happens a lot of times when asteroids hit Earth is they explode in the air because, you know, I'm not going to get into the physics behind it. Yeah, it's a little beyond just hot. But the really cool thing about this story is that we actually heard the asteroid impact over the Atlantic. Because we have across the Earth, I wish we didn't have to have these, but because of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization, that's a mouthful, we have all of these infrasonic microphones, which are listening for really, really low-pitched sounds that might be indicative of a nuclear explosion or something like that. There are only a couple things that create low sounds like this that are really, really loud. And the 10 that I have here are avalanches, earthquakes, auroras, actually. I don't know exactly what the mechanism is there. Severe storms, volcanoes, space debris, meteors, going supersonic, rocket launches, and nuclear explosions. So we can detect all these things. Infrasonic means lower than 20 hertz. This is something that our ears cannot physically detect.
Yeah.
Ultimately, sound is just vibrations. So, you know, if you imagine air moving back and forth really slowly, that's an infrasonic sound. So these are things that we just generally can't detect.
So we have an audio detection system that's listening for global events.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
The idea was that we wanted to be able to tell if someone broke the test ban treaty, mm-hmm. right? And beyond that, where it was.
Yeah.
So if we triangulate based on the signals that we get on all these different microphones, we can actually figure out.
And that's also how we would get volume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
By knowing the distance from the source. Cool.
And yeah.
So asteroid, and we knew it was going to hit prior to it exploding.
Yeah,
because
we
detected it.
Just barely.
Like that's cool.
Like we saw it and we're like, oh, a couple hours from now, that won't be there anymore. That'll be here in our atmosphere.
Yeah, luckily, we'll still be here as well because it's small enough. All right. Miles, what about some deep space news?
Well, it can't get much more deep than a black hole, right? When you think about the singularity, that idea that information just goes into the gaping maw and just...
People call them cosmic vacuum cleaners, which is really a mistaken metaphor, but...
Yeah, suck down in until you get to an infinitely dense material and then it's gone.
All the rules break down. We don't know what's happening.
Space becomes time. Time becomes space.
Yeah, good movies emerge from it.
Yeah, except that...
And really bad ones.
That's what black holes do. They generate sci-fi. That's actually Hawking radiation.
Yeah,
that's actually radiation is sci-fi generation. Yeah.
We have a problem with that because that concept of a black hole, where we think of with general relativity that it
goes in forever.
Yeah, it just goes in forever. And quantum theory, you can't have if you accept the general relativity is true, and experimentation would try to do a whole bunch of stuff and it keeps coming out to be true, darn it. And quantum theory, which by experimentation over and over again we find it keeps having to be true, that black holes as we think they exist with regard to that apparent event horizon can't be true.
Oh, right.
And this being according to Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking has said, there is no escape from a black hole in classical theory, but quantum theory enables energy and information to escape.
Right. This is the Hawking radiation thing principle he's talking about. So don't you have a truism about quantum theory?
Yes, quantum physics makes you stupid.
Nice. Because of course, a truism is a statement that is obviously true and says nothing new or interesting. So thank you very much.
Right. It's the more you learn about it, because Hawking has said, like, we don't really know what goes on with the black hole. Even physicists don't know. And it's this idea that the more you learn about quantum physics, the more you realize that what you assumed was true was wrong. But in so many cases, it's not replaced with anything of comparable volume in your knowledge set. You're left with just unanswered questions of saying, like, wait, what? This isn't true, but what is true?
You know, well, what you knew was wrong. Really sure. Congratulations.
Yeah, so therefore the it's reducing learn. The volume of knowledge that you have. And
you know what? There is a great description of quantum theory from a programmer's perspective. I found this wonderful video. I think it was a Google University thing that talked about quantum theory in a way that you and I would probably really get. Now, I listened to it once, and I need to find it again because I didn't get it. But, you know, sometimes these things take a while.
The more you learn, the less you know. So it's a metaphor for life, quantum theory.
Or maybe we just know too much superfluous wrong information and we do need to do a little bit of selective cutting.
I think you just summarized the show today. So, on Geek Speak from Washington, from Moses Lake, Washington, Eli, welcome to our program. Oh, yes, I have to push that button too. Hey, Eli, welcome.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, no problem. So you emailed us a bit. Can you describe, you're an inventor and a writer, and you're trying to do what with your work?
Well, first of all, I need to correct Miles. It's not the Ukraine, it's just Ukraine.
Ah.
Isn't that coincidental?
I stand corrected.
Ironic, even.
That's the seventh time Miles has been corrected.
Oh, I'm going to kill him.
Miles is trying to strangle me now.
All right, go on. Thank you for, first off, you're winning. So go on.
So I need to create some timestamps because as an inventor, you need to document when you had an idea. And, you know, the typical way you used to do it would be to go to a notary or have two people sign the document every day in your notebook. And, you know, that's kind of outdated and a pain in the butt.
Yeah, and it's possible to forge that as well, potentially.
Well, that's the idea about the notary, is that you have someone else has a record of it.
Right.
So what I want to do is use cryptography to help me timestamp my documents. And there's a few ways to do this online, but basically, you know, I take a lot of pictures of the work I'm doing or the stuff I've scribbled on a whiteboard, stuff I've drawn, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I need a way to, instead of hashing every document and then having to submit, you know, 10 different hash things into, like the blockchain for Bitcoin or something like that.
Okay, so you forwarded us off CryptoStamp.net, which I think is a really cool service. And basically, what CryptoStamp.net is doing, kind of what you want to do, they're taking a whole bunch of unique signatures of files, which are guaranteed to be unique. And then they are using that to generate a Bitcoin wallet, and then they're transferring a little bit of Bitcoin into that wallet. And what that does is that gets duplicated into the Bitcoin chain, and that Bitcoin chain has a lot of people doing it, and therefore it's true that it was included in that in Bitcoin at a certain time. And so because
well, that
of that,
clears everything up.
Well, I know it's a complicated process. It's one of the things I was a little risky about doing, but it's. And I think you're on the right line. I think that what you're planning on doing makes a lot of sense, and describing it to everybody is a little difficult. So we're going to do this for another 2 minutes, and then we're gonna move on.
Move on to some more quantum theory. That's making things a little bit more clear.
That'll be completely clear. But Eli, I think that here's something to denote. You could very easily take a whole bunch of your files, make a zip or a tar of those. You've got to keep that tar or zip, and you cannot let it get modified. Then hash that file, and then send that file up. Because then the same true is happening. The problem, of course, with all of this is that you have to save that original file and the pattern you use to generate it, and you want that to be signed by this external source, which then gets it signed by many people. It's true that you could do a hashing, but it's the more complicated it gets, the more... You know, keep in mind that in the future, the reason to do all this is to convince a judge.
Yeah, the big risk of hashes is... of all hashes is the idea of a collision.
Right.
and that you have two things that are generating the same hash or two or more. And so the more information you can get about your file, like taking a SHA-2 or SHA-3 hash, also taking the file length, actually would be a good thing. Some other
it's actually crucial that you do file length,
the file itself, and then have a service that generates that along with the timestamp to get something. That's probably that's probably a pretty safe bet.
Yeah, and the other thing I'm thinking is that in for example, in the way you use PGP, pretty good privacy through email, is when the wrapper is put around it to encrypt it, it actually also adds what encrypting algorithm is going to be used inside the encryption.
Okay.
So that what you're doing is you're saying this signature or this of this file has been generated with the information necessary to generate the signature of the file. Right. So you're kind of making it safer. Theoretically, you could generate a hash, you could generate a collision. It's a theoretical possibility. And therefore, when Miles says the length, once you say the file length plus a hash, you're really hardening that it's probably unlikely you can make the hash again.
Yeah.
It's just,
the thing is, this is the hard part about cryptography.
Yeah.
Is that for the most part, and myself included, it's really hard to get cryptography right, and basically impossible if you are not a cryptographic researcher who's been in the field dedicated for a decade.
Yep.
So really you are relying upon the skills of other people and kind of hoping for a best case scenario, our best bet. So
and then keep in mind as well that all of this, what your goal is to convince a judge or a jury that you created an invention first. And because that's your goal, if the system is too complicated, you've got a problem as well. And that's why it's like
the human problem.
It what's going to happen if US ever goes to court or whatever, you're going to have an expert, someone like Alex Leas, come up on stage and say, in the courtroom and say, hey, you know what? I've looked at this, and yes, that was definitely stamped at that time. I know that for a fact as an expert, because you can't explain the process to the jury. So that's another thing to think about. What I personally would do in your situation is I would use a tar ball, and I would keep that around. Now, it's kind of a problem because you're going to be duplicating all your content, but basically go through each file and make a hash of it, make a text document and save it in a text document, and then tar that whole directory up, and then create the hash necessary like the crypto stamp people want you to do, or send that file to them and have them do it, and then you are good. Oh, and then download their proof file, because without their proof file, you won't know.
Yeah.
Okay, we're not going to go more into this. We have to keep on going with the show, I think. Lindsay?
I'm just going to channel Bonnie here for a second and have a rest of humanity moment.
I know, that's the thing. It's a hard one.
Just say that there are lawyers who are helping people defend things like this already and dealing with these kinds of things every day. I would find one that has the highest success rate, cough up a bunch of money to talk to them for an hour and find out what all their
that's
other clients
really
are doing.
That's a really good idea. Thank you.
All right.
Eli, thank you for the call, and good luck. I'm really curious, and thank you for telling me about Crypto Stamp. I think it's awesome.
Thank you.
All right, take care. All right, let's go back to the news that I can even understand. That'd be great. So I thought one of the stories this week that was fascinating was Amazon predicting the future. Miles, please tell us how Amazon predicts the future.
Well, I don't know if they're predicting the future as in general. That would be a really neat trick. But they can see patterns in what people are buying and if they're buying things with regularity. One of the problems that you run into is you'll order something, but it's sitting in a warehouse on one side of the country or from the other side of the country from you or the other side of the world. And so you have to wait for that shipping to come to you. So Amazon has this idea that instead of waiting for you to make the order, it's going like, oh, we see this pattern of orders and we're going to ship it closer to you in anticipation of you actually ordering it.
Okay, well, that kind of makes sense.
So shipping the item before you order it. Yeah.
Maybe.
But not shipping it to the person before they order it, just shipping it closer to them.
You know, I imagine if Amazon is moving a lot of goods around, they're probably doing it on these huge pallets, and sometimes you have extra room maybe on the pallets. I don't know if that would be a potential thing that they could utilize as well. You know, so in that case, the shipping is kind of free for them.
Yeah,
if they're paying for the pallet. I don't know.
And you're right. It is to fulfillment centers, not to the individual. So okay. You're not going to end up with packages randomly on your doorstep guy asking you for to
but
sign
you could
a bill.
Say that you could say that you know if someone says, hey, wait, why did you ship all that stuff from Detroit to San Jose? Why'd you do that? And Amazon would say, because these 80 customers are going to order in the next 4 days that item. That is kind of weird, right? Because those people haven't decided to do that yet.
20%.
But Amazon knows they're
20% of these 500 customers are probably going
right, to. That's the thing, is it's an average, right?
Big numbers, right?
You're right. But it's still kind of creepy to think that I'm about to buy something, and because I'm about to buy something, it's likely that Amazon's already shipped it closer to me. That's weird. Like, from an individual's perspective, that's an odd chain of events to think
about. If we think a bit about it from the individual's perspective, it's weird and creepy. If we think about it from the big picture, I mean, people in San Jose probably buy more technology than people in Kansas. That's my guess. So, assuming the numbers back that up, they're probably going to have more,
Okay. And the numbers back up, unfortunately, that, I'm sorry, we are not all unique snowflakes.
Aww.
I'm a unique snowflake.
Shut up.
Every snowflake is unique.
This has been Geek Speak for January 25th, 2014, with Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, and Lindsay Lonnie. I'm Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed on Geek Speak are not necessarily those of anybody but ourselves. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And of course, you can learn everything about Geek Speak up at our website, geekspeak.org. Thank you so much for listening to our program today. We'll see you next week.